Welcome back to the Infotagent podcast, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom. This is the first major public health crisis in the age of social media disinformation, and we're here to try and make sense of it. I'm Damien Collins MP, co-founder of Infotagent, and today we're joined by Claire Wardle, the executive director of First Draft in New York, a non-profit organisation with a mission to empower societies with accurate information in critical moments. Alongside her is Joey Durso, a journalist who has reported on politics and disinformation for the BBC and BuzzFeed UK. We'll also be hearing, as always, from our resident experts, the disinformation analyst Dr. Charles Creel and John Quinlan, the CEO of Iconic Labs. In this podcast, we'll be talking about the different forms of disinformation and how we need to give people the tools they need to respond to them. Claire, if I could come to you first. I remember we first met when you were at the Shorstein Center at the Kennedy School in Harvard, and you were doing an important piece of work looking at how we classify different types of disinformation, looking at the way disinformation spreads. Over the last few years, you've probably been as close to this subject as anyone. Do you think that disinformation is becoming even more sophisticated in its techniques? And should we be concerned not just about the work of foreign actors, Russian agencies in disinformation, but also disinformation which spreads and is created from within our own communities as well?
Yeah, it's very true that I've been in this space for a number of years. And I think what's really depressing is seeing everything that we've been watching for the last few years play out in a really distressing way around the coronavirus. So I would argue that the tactics and techniques that we're seeing now are the same tactics and techniques that we have been monitoring, because people know that they work. The difference now is that you have people at a heightened level of fear and concern and confusion, and that's what's breeding this spreading as quickly as it is. So I think what we're seeing more of now is kind of misinformation, which is people sharing on information that they don't realize is false. They don't mean any harm, but they're being manipulated by actors who want to push out or sow confusion or make people more fearful. So it's difficult right now to say how much of this stuff is being pushed by foreign actors and how much is domestic. But I'm definitely spending less of my time worried about that. I'm worried about my mum and my uncle and friends from high school who I'm seeing now share more of this stuff than ever before.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of what we've seen with Infotagent reflects that. And I think we need to try to achieve a change in mindset for people that if you see something, don't share it because it might be true. And if it was true, it's important. Make sure you really check whether something's true before you share it. And I don't think people have necessarily been in that place for a while.
No, and I think the conversation of the last 3 years has been blaming the platforms or blaming governments for not doing enough. And we didn't necessarily say, actually, we're the ones that are passing this on. If we didn't share any of this, we wouldn't have a problem. And we have been weaponized. We have to understand that. But we have to recognize our role in all of this. And I just don't think we've been having those conversations with each other.
And I mean, do you think, I think you touched on it a little bit, that where it's individuals, members of the public who are inadvertently sharing things that aren't true, that the role of the more organized disinformation campaigns is to spot that and then amplify it. So they're not having to create the content themselves, but they're amplifying false messages which may suit their own interests.
Yeah, I would say that in many ways, we as publics around the world are doing a lot of this stuff ourselves. You know, we're talking to one another and then saying in WhatsApp, oh, my sister's a nurse and what she's saying. And then by the time it gets shared around, it's actually turned into misinformation. So, yeah, I think if I was a bad actor, I would be sitting somewhere with my whiteboard being like, oh, don't have to do much today. Because unfortunately, we're already in a situation where we're doing a lot of this stuff to ourselves.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're now based at First Draft in New York. And yes. First Draft's mission is to empower societies with accurate information. I mean, what sort of things are you doing, and what sort of advice could you give to try and help us in this battle against disinformation and misinformation?
So I'd say over the last few years, we definitely used to play the role of seeing something that was false and debunking it and pushing out that debunking. But I would argue one of the biggest challenges right now is that simply we don't have access to accurate information, or even information where there's a consensus, because it's only 5 months since we first heard about the coronavirus. And on a lot of aspects of this virus, we just don't have scientific consensus. And so there's a lot of what we call data voids. So we spend a lot of every day just monitoring Google Trends data to see what questions people are asking of Google, and to then work with newsrooms to help them kind of create content that might help to explain some of those points of confusion, or where people, you know, are saying, you know, I don't understand this. And so I think in many ways, those of us who are trying to tackle misinformation, yes, we have to ensure that we're debunking false information, but I also think we have to understand that it is flourishing in spaces where there is confusion and there's an absence of explanation. And I think that, again, is something that newsrooms don't necessarily consider. And every single day, because we're ultimately in a crisis, I think something to remember is we need to think like crisis communication officials. So if there is a wildfire in California, you listen to the police chief and he says, well, today the fire is here. Tomorrow it might be here, here, or here. I can't tell you where the fire is going to be, but listen to me and I will tell you all the information I have. And I think we failed to do that with coronavirus. And so what that has led to is people say, well, you told me not to wear masks. Now you're telling me to wear masks. You told me if I was under 60, I was fine. Now you're telling me I'm not. And unfortunately, because we didn't approach this as a crisis communication professional, and I say that as the whole news industry and governments, what that has led to is people losing trust in official sources. And that is the crisis that I'm really worried that we're sort of sleepwalking into. And I just wish we need to be more transparent with the public. We need to think about how do we think about information when we simply don't know enough and everything we know is changing almost on a weekly basis.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, as we know, for some of the agents of disinformation, confusion is for them quite a good outcome. If you just end up where people don't know who to believe or what to believe, then they could believe anything.
Exactly. And so we're seeing disinformation actors trying to undermine Dr. Fauci, or they're undermining the World Health Organization. And that is a deliberate tactic, because if you can make people turn away from those official sources and start turning towards each other in WhatsApp groups and email threads, that's how you see these conspiracy theories breeding, because people say, we can't believe the officials, I'll tell you the real story. And I think that's one thing I'd say with the coronavirus, is that we've seen real growth in conspiracy theories moving into the mainstream in a way that, of course, we've had conspiracy theories for a long time, but they tended to be pretty fringe. And now I'm seeing, again, you know, friends from school or family members sharing information that previously they would never previously have touched. And I think that the rise in conspiracy theories is because people are scared, and things like, we don't have an origin story for the virus. We don't have a treatment yet. And in the absence of those firm narratives, it's allowing these conspiracies to flourish.
Absolutely. I mean, Joey, you as a journalist, well, you know, BBC and at BuzzFeed, I mean, you've taken a big interest in the way fake news is developed and spread. And I'd be interested in your views on that, and whether you agree with Claire on what she said. But first off, I mean, do you feel as a journalist there is a kind of news is on the spot, there's a spotlight on news, and there is a pressure on journalists now because of the lack of trust in official sources of information that disinformation has helped spread?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think Claire mentioned this idea of debunking and how useful that is. And sometimes it's feel like a sort of whack-a-mole, and you say, oh, this thing isn't true. But, you know, whether that actually works, whether that actually adds any value, and it can seem sort of exhausting at times. And it seems like the things that get through to people perhaps are when you introduce characters or show this is the person who's behind the misinformation, or this is why people share some. So I suppose it's trying to do journalism like that that gets a bit beyond just saying stuff that isn't true, because why would people believe that? You know, you have to kind of get people further down the chain than just saying something isn't true. I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about this pandemic that I've noticed is people who wouldn't necessarily be seen as misinformation spreaders who are becoming them. There's lots around sort of pseudoscience. And I did a story about these London-based yoga teachers who run a big Facebook page about alternative therapies. And up until March, that was mainly about, you know, alternative medicine, stuff like that, stuff that was maybe a bit suspect in scientific terms, but wasn't really doing a massive amount of harm. And that had pivoted to really quite harmful stuff about coronavirus misinformation. And some of these platforms have a huge reach, and they're hitting people that wouldn't necessarily agree with some of the wilder conspiracy theories at first, but when they're sort of led to it through this world of pseudoscience, it means it can reach much more people.
Absolutely. And I think it brings us into an interesting area of discussion on this, which is the orchestrated architecture of disinformation, and groups like that's a really great example. And there's been some other studies looking at groups in Italy that were that had big audiences largely talking about football, which suddenly then pivoted into talking about far more extreme political messages. I mean, do you think this is an area where actually, you know, we do need the big tech companies to be doing a bit more and helping us more, because ultimately they're the ones that can see what is going on with these big groups?
I think so. And there's just so much stuff going on. It's, you know, their argument is that it's impossible to track it all, but maybe that isn't good enough when they've got the profits that they do and the resources that they do. Maybe they, you know, shouldn't be, you know, trying to do as much or in so many countries. Or I did another story about how there was a misleading health story about lemons and that curing coronavirus, this sort of rubbish that we've seen. And that was pretty much debunked or shut down in English, but in Romanian, basically exactly the same thing was had massive reach. And, you know, because it's a huge problem for Facebook that because it exists in all these different languages and it doesn't necessarily have content moderators in all of those languages or with a understanding of the culture of the specific country, that it's just such a vast problem. And there's so much going on Facebook that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg does not know what's happening each day on every corner of Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, on the day we're recording this, the BBC has just broadcast a big interview with Mark Zuckerberg, where he talks about, again, the limitations of what you can do to act on free speech. But I think there is quite still a really important debate here, because free speech, people have the right to express their opinions, but do they have the right to use a social media network to effectively broadcast those opinions to millions of people multiple times a day without any responsibilities being placed on them at all? And, you know, it's an example of how freedom of speech and freedom of reach are not quite the same thing. I mean, for you as a journalist, you know, you have free speech, but you can't just say anything you like. And you have an editor you have to report to. There's a regulator that oversees what you do. And do you think this is ultimately where we're going to need to try and create some more effective rules of the road for social media?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and the rules have changed in the last few months. For example, making a link between 5G and coronavirus is now banned by YouTube and Facebook in a way it wasn't. There's another development around the rules for advocating breaching social distancing rules. There are protests organized in America telling people to hug each other or whatever, and that has been banned by Facebook. And that's, you know, 6 months ago that never would have been banned. So the platforms are trying, you know, read this idea of harm, right? If, you know, if someone says you should go and kill yourself or something, everyone would agree that that was a direct harm could lead from it and that that should be removed. But this definition of what harm means is constantly developing and changing, and the platforms are trying to react to that and tightening things up. But I mean, you could very easily make the argument that there's a huge amount on there that directly leads to harm that isn't being removed. And there's huge groups, you know, particularly around vaccines, which is going to be a huge issue for the rest of this, you know, as the world searches for this elusive vaccine.
Absolutely. I mean, this is going to be one of the big challenges. If we're in a position where we've got a vaccine, there'll be probably lots of people on social media saying, don't take it because it's dangerous.
You know, you might have a situation where airline companies are saying you can't get on a plane if you don't have the vaccine, or schools might not let kids in if they don't have it. So the consequences of refusing a vaccine like that would be pretty momentous. But you've got certainly very active groups on Facebook that say this is all, you know, a scam. It's Bill Gates. It's trying to microchip you to track you. And it's and also, you've got to remember, these vaccines are under massive pressure, and it's highly likely that, you know, the first one might not work, or there could be negative results, side effect or something. And people could latch on to things like that to debunk the whole concept of a vaccine, which would be incredibly dangerous for humanity.
And how, I mean, just before I bring in Charles and John into the conversation, I mean, as a journalist reporting on social media, how have you found the social media companies to work with?
They get back to you quite quickly. Often, you know, we flag, it feels like you're almost doing your work for them, because you flag things and then they remove them, and they, you know, this breaches our policies. But it's, you always sort of think, should this be the way around that it is? Things be more preemptively, you know, moderated. And yeah, I mean, there's been loads of examples of reporting where journalists have uncovered massive things at Facebook, and then of course, when the journalists have approached Facebook, YouTube, they've removed them. But yeah, there are always huge question marks about why that was on the platform in the first place.
No, I completely agree, and I think there is a question: why is it that way around? Why is it they only take stuff down if it's brought to their attention, when they can see it anyway? I remember during the Select Committee inquiry, we asked Facebook privately whether they would look to see whether there was evidence of Russian interference in UK politics, as there had been in America. And they said, well, if you can find evidence of it and bring it to us, then we'll look. But it's not our job to go and find it. Which, you know, you think, well, if you were running a, if you ran a bank in that way, in terms of the money laundering rules, you'd lose your license. You know, but for the social media companies, that seems to be absolutely fine. Charles Creel, you're with us again, and it's great to have you. And what's caught your eye in the last few days?
The thing that's caught my eye, Damien, is preprints. It's an old phenomenon in academic publishing, and it's starting to take on a new life and has become this huge source of disinformation in the corona crisis, preprints. Normally in academia, when a researcher comes up with a new theory, what they'll do is write up a paper, and then the paper itself goes through a peer review process. This means that several academics, senior academics usually, who are specialists in the field, will review the paper, they'll make comments, they'll send the researcher back to the lab for rewrites, or maybe just send the whole thing packing. And this is a method designed to establish academic truth, but it's also incredibly slow. It means it takes several years before an idea for a major finding could pass its way to the public. So to deal with this, what researchers sometimes release are preprints, that is, research findings that haven't been through a rigorous process of peer review. And this is to get vital information to other researchers faster, which obviously now would be the time for that. They're not meant for the public. They're meant for other researchers. But academics are also like the rest of us. They like a lot of attention. And unfortunately, a few end up speaking to the press about their findings before they've been reviewed. And if you add the idea of the internet and a major global health crisis into the mix, what you end up with is massive potential for disinformation. And here's an idea of the scale of the problem. More than 10,000 academic works have been published about COVID-19 alone just since January, and 3,500 of them are preprints. Now, back in April, which is nearly ancient history in this crisis, a group of Stanford University researchers published a paper claiming that reports of the number of people infected by coronavirus are wildly low, that maybe 50 to 85 times more people have been infected than official figures show. And it was even mentioned on our show. But it was also immediately seized upon by press outlets advocating for an early return to work and opening up of lockdown. And then two things happened. First, within a few days, there were more than 450 comments made by academics and others on the original online publication of the preprint, and they tore the article to shreds. The methodology was off, the tests they used were invalid, they weren't FDA approved, on and on. The second thing is that within 24 hours of publication, the article had made its way into the mainstream press via the anti-lockdown press, and the study was being taken as fact and wielded as a weapon. So commentators said it proved that infection rates might be as low as 0.12%, which is what the researchers said, but that would make COVID-19 only as deadly as seasonal flu. So Fox News, The Daily Caller, Spectator US, a lot of others tweeted about the study and with the hashtags Reopen America, Facts Not Fear, End the Lockdown, and so on. And this piece of misinformation, like so many others, has now passed into the public imagination as though it's a piece of truth backed by science. So the moral of this is about checking references on studies, but particularly when you see that something has not been peer-reviewed and that it's pre-press.
Very good. And John, what's news at Infotagen?
Hey, Damien. Yeah, no, it's mixture this week. And it's, you know, it's obviously good to hear Joey and Claire there. They sound like kindred spirits to what we're doing. And particularly Joey's stuff, we've seen some of those things as well. I think a couple of things this week, but one of the things that caught our eye was actually a fact check that we did around, did the Gates Foundation just lose a big vaccination court case? So, I mean, as far as it goes, that's pretty much hit every key word going at the moment, with Bill Gates in there, vaccination in there, there's lockdown in there. Andrew Wakefield also made an appearance, a name mentioned in it. So it's a YouTube video, and of course goes, you know, of course needs to be said that it's not true. The court case was between two groups, the Informed Consent Action Network and the Center for Disease Control. The court did not rule in favor of ICANN. It was dismissed after the CDC produced numerous scientific studies that show that vaccines do not cause autism. However, I think, you know, apart from that, it's so interesting to see, and it's something that Joey in particular mentioned, that, you know, Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation being drawn into that. They obviously partly fund the CDC, but they have nothing at all to do with this case. But, you know, for the sake of this YouTube video and this bit of misinformation, it's obviously suiting someone to put it out there that, you know, that they're at the heart of this kind of conspiracy. So I think that's quite interesting, and it's something we've seen before, and I'm sure we'll see again.
Absolutely. I mean, Claire and Joey, to what extent do you think there's a bit of a read across between medical disinformation around coronavirus and some of the political disinformation we've seen in the past? I mean, reference to Bill Gates, I mean, there are some pretty consistent characters who are attacked by these networks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first month of the coronavirus outbreak, you know, the misinformation was things like gargle salt water. It felt very kind of pure health misinformation. But in the last month, have we seen these conspiracies grown? And I'm based in the US, and so we're obviously tracking these so-called excessive quarantine protests. And now we're really seeing politics intersect with the coronavirus and health. And so I think this idea that, oh, look at the platforms, they've done this for health misinformation, they can do the same for political disinformation. The challenge for them now is actually it is speech connected to politics. So I think the next few months are going to be pretty interesting to see as this intersection becomes much clearer, how this impacts the policies on the platform's behalf.
Yeah, and I think in the UK, massive generalization with lots of exceptions, but it's a bit on left, right, seeing people on the right, publications like The Telegraph and The Spectator, tending to be in favor of easing the lockdown measures. And you've got the left who and the Labour Party sort of the opposite and saying you should keep things strict, you know, even though, you know, Boris Johnson and the government are retaining this fairly strict lockdown for the foreseeable future. And it's seeing those things that are traditionally in the realm of epidemiology and science and experts becoming political. And we're seeing that certainly in the US and world.
And do you think, I mean, do you both think that given that the platforms have been prepared to act on content, I mean, Joe, you rightly said that Facebook had changed decided that conspiracy theories around 5G will be removed, that if you're a disinformation person, you might think, well, actually, the closer we can weave our disinformation into political messaging, the harder it will be for companies to act against it.
I think that's true. Lots of markets with them, they've used the phrase general conspiracy theories. And what that means is conspiracy theories which aren't directly causing to health. You know, if you say the world is run by a bunch of lizards, you know, the Illuminati, New World Order, that kind of comes under the realm of general conspiracy theory, and platforms generally think that they should not be removed. And, you know, there is a legitimate free speech argument there. People should be allowed to question the official, people should be allowed to believe, you know, out there things. It becomes a lot more fraught when these conspiracy theories about totalitarian governments, which a year ago might have been just a few weeks, are actually becoming really, you know, relevant to how a lot of people see the world in the wake of coronavirus. And, you know, the idea of an international government, which is a sort of very old-fashioned conspiracy theory, you know, governments are coordinating in ways they weren't before. There's actually a really interesting example. Gordon Brown, the former leader, gave a quote in some interview saying there should be unified governance over coronavirus or something. And it was quite a, you know, a standard thing to say about how governments should be working together. But this was seized upon as, you know, former British Prime Minister wants a new world order. And so, yeah, we're really seeing that blurring between really eccentric conspiracies and kind of mainstream things at the moment that lots of people are believing, which I think hasn't really happened before in the age of social media.
And I mean, Claire, as we sort of start bringing this to a close for the podcast, I mean, do you think we need to be better at creating tools that help people navigate their way through disinformation? I think it's right that we put pressure on the tech companies to do more. And with Infotagen, we have a fact-checking service, so we're encouraging people to use it. But we always say, well, there's a role for the public too. But you know, is it always easy for them to navigate their way through this?
I completely agree that I started this podcast talking about we have to take responsibility ourselves, and we also have to hold each other to account. So I think we've got into this habit of just muting our old high school friends or crazy Uncle Bob. And actually what we need to do is to be having conversations with each other about the harm that this kind of information can cause. But rather than sending potentially a link from Infotagen to be like, here you are, Bob, this just proves that you're wrong. If you do that, it actually kind of shames Uncle Bob, makes him embarrassed. And because the information we share is tied to our identities, people tend to double down when you tell them they're wrong. And so actually we just need to teach one another about how to have these difficult conversations. And unfortunately it is easier to mute, but I think we're now at a point where, yes, you can say, well, you know, click on the WHO, they're going to tell you the truth. But actually a more effective way is to talk to one another about this, because we are more trusted as messengers. And I think we haven't necessarily given people the tools or the skills to know how to have those conversations. And I do think that's the next phase of the way that we approach disinformation.
I mean, you mentioned the WHO there, and we use them as a fact-checking service. But do you, well, not fact, but as a source of source for information. I mean, in that context, though, do you think at this moment in time for the Americans to withdraw from the WHO, you know, massively undermines quite an important international body that's trying to advise people as best it can on this important issue?
Yeah, I mean, it's horrific to think about the undermining of a global health authority in the middle of a pandemic. But it's a strategic decision, because by doing that, well, there's many reasons for doing it. But unfortunately, in this space of information, by doing that, it means people can question quality information. But you know, there have also been mistakes. There was a tweet on the 14th of January from the WHO that said there's no evidence of human transmission of the coronavirus. And that goes back to my point earlier, which is we have to make people understand how knowledge is created and produced, how science works, to that really good conversation about preprints. And I think the WHO has had some missteps, but unfortunately the defunding of it, the conversations in the US about the WHO are really, really damaging, because if we don't have a central authority based on scientific evidence during a global pandemic, we're in trouble.
Absolutely. I mean, as a final question for me, I mean, direct principally towards Jerry, but welcome any other views on it as well. I mean, one of the consistent things that runs through a lot of the disinformation and misinformation that we see is the attack on the mainstream media. And that term being used as a kind of a term of abuse, almost to say, well, you know, they only tell you what they want you to hear. And I mean, do you think, Joey, there is a kind of, the danger is a bit of a crisis point for the media as well, and that if public trust in the media is undermined in this way, that could be hugely damaging for society?
I think that's true. I think there's been a sort of argument between pollsters in Britain recently about whether there is the trust in the media has declined as a result of coronavirus. I think the conclusion was that trust in the media is really low, but it's always been low, which isn't massively inspiring, but there we go. I think, you know, if you ask people, do you trust the media? They tend to say no. We know that from lots of polls, but we do know that people have been turning to, you know, big news outlets in bigger numbers. And so there is some reason for optimism, but it's certainly a really dangerous time for the media that lots of people just, you know, I often find that I join all these Facebook groups or misinformation things on my account, which I use for that. And I also have all sorts of other things, including news outlets. And when I open the feed, I see the crazy stuff, which is the experience that lots of people are having. That's their media for the day. So it is a pretty scary time to be working in the media.
It would be a great exercise if you could screenshot the homepages of people, different people's social media accounts to see how they see the world through that lens.
Yeah, there have been studies into this. I mean, every single person who uses Facebook has their own algorithm, has their own set of things that they like and dislike, or, you know, a page they like years ago, or click on particularly on what they see. And that's different for all of us. And it's impossible to just what, you know, a vote in Ohio in the election might be seeing, or, you know, a mother in Northern England, or, you know, everyone has a different Facebook feed. And that didn't used to be the case. People used to watch BBC News or read, you know, they might read a right-wing newspaper or a left-wing newspaper, but you pretty much knew what was in it. And now we don't.
Absolutely. Well, I think we have to draw the discussion to a close there. Claire and Joey, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. And Charles and John, it's great to have you here again.
You've been listening to the Infotagen podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Claire Wardle, Joey Durso, Charles Creel, and John Quinlan. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag IsolateTheLies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you until next time.